I'm going to be talking about
this
model we're proposing for extreme scattering events in the ISM, and calling it the cusp-off-cusp model.
That's
sort of a work in, you know, I'm happy to workshop the name so that it doesn't roll off the tongue, but we'll see why it's called that. So, you know, this is just an overview of what I'll be talking about, just going through the observational and theoretical context, and then talking about what I'm actually, what this model actually is, and then some potential applications of it. So to begin with, you know, the observational context is that we've been seeing these so-called extreme scattering events for, you know, 3 decades now, over that. You know, the first one was seen in 1987 in quasars. So basically, an extreme scattering event is just something you see in radio sources sometimes, which is these large flux modulations that, you know, occur over a time scale of about a month or several months. And, you know, we think it's due to scattering in the ISM. And we observe this in quasars and pulsars. I want to point out that they're not exactly rare events. They're extreme, but not rare. You know, so, for example, in pulsars, about 1% of the time you expect to see something like this. There's been a lot of renewed interest in these recently. For one, you know, we expect that FRBs will be scattered by the same sort of, by the same structures in the ISM. So, you know, this has implications for if you're doing FRB cosmology. But it also has.
When you talk about FRBs and quasars, are you thinking about ISM or IGM?
I'm thinking about the ISM. I will mention that, you know, you might see something like this in the IGM as well, or, you know, maybe in the local environment of the FRB. But certainly, we know that pulsars are lensed by this, by the ISM, and then FRBs, you know, may cross the same lines of sight to the ISM, and you may see something like this.
I mean, do we know where these, I mean, what is responsible for this? Is it, should it be in our galaxy or could it be somewhere in between?
Yeah, so for quasars, it should be in our galaxy, I think, is the expectation. But I don't know if we've seen anything that might be, you know, the origin might be something else. I'm not sure about that.
Because, I mean, for regular lensing, you expect it to be somewhere halfway.
Yeah.
But you're saying these are kind of, you need to be in galaxies for these. I don't know. I guess maybe you kind of tell us why.
But so certainly for pulsars. I mean, obviously for pulsars, it's the ISM. And I think most, if not all, of the events for quasars, you know, to be in the ISM. But I would have to check. Okay. So anyway, so this has, for pulsars, this has some, you know, implications for pulsar timing arrays. You know, these, if you want to do pulsar timing arrays, you need to be able to measure differences in times of arrival with pulsars. So, you know, these large variations in scattering time due to these extreme scattering events can sort of mess that up a bit. Another thing that we know pulsars, that happen to pulsars, is scintillation. So this is just another propagation effect that is due to the ISM. So pulsars have this interference effect. See this nice interference pattern in frequency and time that pulsars exhibit. And, you know, the origins of this scintillation remain a bit of a mystery. We know it's caused by the ISM, but we don't know what structures in the ISM exactly cause it. And, you know, you can ask the question is, are these phenomena related to each other?
I mean,
is it the case that ESEs are caused by some completely different thing? Scintillation is caused by another structure, and these are just different phenomena? Or is there some relation between these two things? I mean, we know they're caused by plasma structures in the ISM, but are the origins of these things completely different?
You see the experiments on the axes of these plots?
Yes, so I will explain what these plots are, because they will come up quite a bit. This is sort of a common thing that people do in pulsar scintillometry. So to start with, the sort of observable that we're dealing with is the wave field,
which my cursor visible? Yeah, you can kind of see my cursor.
But the wave field is just the voltage that you observe as a function of frequency and time. So this is what you call, well, the intensity, so the voltage, the absolute value of the voltage is the dynamic spectrum. So that's the lingo. But it's just your electric field is a function of frequency and time. And basically, to some approximation, it's just the sum of plane waves. Basically, the picture is your pulsar is scattered, and it has a bunch of, that this forms a bunch of images on the sky, and then these images all interfere at the observer. So it's just a bunch of interfering plane waves, some time delay associated with them, essentially. And so a thing that is very useful to look at oftentimes is the 2D Fourier transform of these observables. So one thing that we do is take the conjugate wave field. So that's this this quantity. So this is first take the Fourier transform along the frequency axis, and then you take the Fourier transform along the time axis. So then you get these conjugate variables, tau, which is delay. I guess I've swapped them. So tau it has units of time, so that's the conjugate variable to frequency. And then this FD has units of frequency, so that's the conjugate variable to time. And because our observable is sort of a sum of plane waves, then when you go into Fourier space, you basically just get a sum of delta functions. And they are, these delta functions are localized to where tau is equal to the time delay associated with each image. And this conjugate variable that has a unit of frequency, we call that the Doppler shift associated with these images. So essentially, if you were to have infinite resolution in this space, what you would expect in this conjugate wave field here is just a bunch of delta functions, each associated with an image on the sky. And this is, we call this the Doppler delay space, because the x-axis is the Doppler shift associated with the image, and the y-axis is the delay. And then the secondary spectrum is this other thing that we look at, which is just the 2D Fourier transform of the intensity, which is just the autocorrelation of the conjugate wave field. And sort of, and this is what's shown in the bottom plot here. The real and imaginary part of it is shown in the bottom plot here. And it's just basically the autocorrelation of the top plot. Okay, so those pictures will show up quite a bit. So hopefully that's sort of clear.
Go back there? So is this for a scintillation event, or is this just for generic pulsar behavior? What are you playing here around?
This is for a scintillation. But most pulsars exhibit scintillation. So for pretty much, it's something like this is ubiquitous with pulsars. This is sort of a very nice, clean event where you get these very clear inverted arclets. But this sort of parabolic structure is, you'll see this in pretty much every pulsar that you look at.
If it's not scintillating, then what do you see here?
If it's not scintillating, it's more of like a blob. But it's unclear whether or not, if you were to, this is just because this parabolic arc structure is not being resolved, or if there's no scintillation. I don't think we know yet, because it could be that the structure is causing scintillation, vary a lot in scale, so you may not be resolving it all the time, or it could be just some lines of sight don't have things that cause scintillation. So there's this. This is the theoretical context. So we have a lot of sort of phenomenological models for explaining both ESEs and scintillation. There are sort of infinite degrees of freedom. You see an event, you just try to come up with some function that for the plasma structure that explains the shape, and you try to fit what you observe. So that's something that people do a lot. This you often run into a problem, and this is called the overpressure problem. And this is if you assume that the plasma structures are spherically symmetric, then this will lead to inferences of the electron density of order 10 to the 3 cubic centimeter, which has associated with it roughly 10 to the 4 Kelvin temperature. And so this is a problem.
This is much hotter
than what you expect the ISM to be. And it's called the overpressure problem because these things will, if they were this hot, they
sort of just
dissipate very quickly and quicker than on the time scales we observe these events. So that's sort of a problem there. Another thing that's difficult to model with the ESCs is, I mean, if I go back to this first Fiedler et al. Observation, it was they observed in two bands, two bands. This one is like 2.7 gigahertz and this is 8.1 gigahertz. And you see that the light curve is very different at the different frequencies. And in a lot of papers that attempt to model these events, they'll model, say, the lower frequency band with something. And then, the higher frequency band, and you can invoke like, oh, there's some small scale structure that causes a completely different thing. So, it's challenging to model both of these at the same time with the same thing, with the same plasma structure. Usually people, I wouldn't say usually, but often people just invoke a small scale structure that will explain this thing here that they don't attempt to model. So matching both frequency bands with the same model is difficult.
Another nice question. So can you call the difference between the two events, the extreme scattering events and the scintillations?
Oh, well, so, I mean, the extreme scattering events, with scintillation, we don't see these extremely large flux modulations. I mean, you can get fairly strong scintillation, but you don't see these, like, very large caustics that occur in, in these extreme scattering events. Another thing that distinguishes these things is the bending angle you infer. The bending angle and the delay. So for example, here, in this space, the delay can be very large. The bending angle is also much larger than in scintillation events. So that's sort of what distinguishes these things. Also the time scale, I should say the time scale, the extreme scattering events can last, I guess the time scale is not that different. You can imagine there being overlap. The scintillation pattern can be stable for quite a long time. Time scale is similar. So, I guess that's not really much of a difference there. But the main thing is just that you get these large bending angles associated with it and large time delays. So there are, a multitude of physical models that people have proposed to explain this. Some of them are sort of standard, like you imagine the ISM is just this Kolmogorov turbulent medium. Some are more exotic. There has been a proposal that dark matter is actually these clumps of neutral clouds that have form these ionized skins around them. And then maybe this can explain ESCs. This model of folded magnetic reconnection sheets is something I'll talk about a little bit more. But in any case, there are lots of physical models that people use to try to explain these ESCs. But I don't think there's anything that's particularly convincing. What would a good model be? That's, I think, a good thing to start out with so that we know if we've solved our problem. So first of all, it has to solve the overpressure problem. This turns out is not super hard to solve. I think most people, it's not so much an overpressure problem anymore as it is evidence that that these structures are thin sheets. And so the reason for that is the overpressure problem really only arises if you assume spherical symmetry. But if you assume that it's a thin sheet, let's say very that's sort of aligned with your line of sight. I mean, what really is the thing that causes lensing is the projected density. So even if the density of the sheet is not that large, when you project it onto a plane, you know, you can get quite large projected densities. So this thin sheet thing, you know, I think there is a pretty good evidence that most of these plasma structures must be thin in some sense of the word. So if you have a model, you probably want it to accommodate thin plasma sheets. One is another goal.
No observational signature from the sheets that you don't see kind of like edge on?
Yeah, so that's one of the things that I think we are trying to get at. We hope to get with, especially with, you know, where I was saying when you don't see scintillation, you kind of get this blobby structure. And it could be that we could model this with, you know, these more weaker things that you aren't seeing edge on. So this, when you look at the scintillation pattern, you get this very strong arc. That would be one of these edge-on sheets. But then you get a lot of power at lower delays and whatnot. And maybe it could be the case that this is caused by these less edge-on sheets. I mean, you would expect to get to encounter a lot of these things along the line of sight. But you seem to be dominated by the edge-on sheets. But that doesn't mean that's the only thing that's going on. It's not super clear that's the case. I think that's just sort of the expectation. I don't think anybody has definitively shown that you actually are getting, that the scintillation is described by an edge-on sheet plus a bunch of weaker, not edge-on sheets. Another thing that would be nice to be able to do is to accurately model the ESEs across frequencies, like I was saying, in that original observation across multiple frequency bands. And one thing is that we would, this is maybe less of a goal and more of a hope, that the model could explain both ESEs and scintillation. Because, most of the physical models, or a lot of the physical models that have proposed, are just trying to explain ESCs. We know that they're both caused by scattering in the ISM. It would be great if we could say, actually they're caused by the same thing, different aspects of the same thing, but the same kind of thing explains the origin of both of these. Another sort of aspiration is that our model would provide a simple framework for analyzing these events, a few parameters, and this is because, you can always fit whatever light curve you see with, if you have infinite degrees of freedom, but it would be nice if you had some model that sort of limits your ability to just write down a function that explains your light curves, so that you could actually start making unambiguous predictions about what, and then inferences about the ISM. So what is the model that we are proposing? It's not so much a model, I guess, as it is a framework, but I'll talk about that. I'm calling it doubly catastrophic lensing. So why doubly catastrophic? Well, for first layer of catastrophes is that, in lensing theory, catastrophes naturally arise. So a catastrophe is basically a singularity in the lens map. So the lens map just takes points in the source plane, maps it to points in the lens plane, and singularities in this map, they manifest as basically formally infinite intensity. So at one of these singularities, you have formally infinite magnification, and so you get these nice caustic patterns that appear. So where you get these really bright sort of folds and cusps, and so that's the first layer of catastrophes. The catastrophes are these singularities in the lens map. But then, you might ask the question, what if the lenses themselves were catastrophes? So what this picture is the magnification due to some lens. But what if instead of the magnification, this was the lens? What if, what if this was my lens potential? So that's sort of what I'm proposing here, is that the lenses in the ISM take the forms of these catastrophes. And so that's sort of doubly catastrophic. And why would you do that? Okay, sure, that's sort of a fun idea, but why would you do that? Well, okay, so if we take the overpressure problem as evidence for the fact that these lenses have to be thin sheets, then our lensing is basically described by some projection, right? We have some sheet that's being projected onto the plane perpendicular line of sight. And you know, when you have projections, just mathematically, this is basically a map from one space to another. And very naturally, you get singularities in this map. And singularities give rise to these caustic structures. So if indeed projection is, you know, really our lenses are explained by some kind of projection, then these caustics should naturally arise as the lens potential. So I will give a diagram to hopefully explain this a little bit more clearly. So here's sort of the picture that we have in mind. So you know, we have your source and your observer, and we imagine the lens is some kind of corrugated sheet, right? We want it to be thin, and it has some modulation on top. You know, this is very regular. I don't imagine it to be a perfect sinusoid, but it's just for the sake of the diagram. It's just sort of this corrugated sheet. So like I was saying, you know, because the lens is thin, you can effectively describe the lensing by a projected density. So this blue is the actual lens, but then the effective density is this projected density, which is this gray curve. And you can see that, you know, when you project it, you get these sort of large peaks. And you can imagine that as I tilt it, you know, even I align it even more with the line of sight, you're going to get these peaks are going to get even larger and larger. And in fact, when it's totally aligned, you get formally infinite. Will become formally infinite. If this is for a perfectly thin lens, if your lens is infinitely thin, that's the case. But if it has some extent, then you don't really get infinities. It gets smoothed out by a little bit. But that's sort of a detail. Did you have a question? Yeah, so that's the top right is what this model would predict. The Doppler is basically, you know, that's sort of dominated by the motion of the source. So,
the plasma is fixed.
The plasma is fixed, but the source is moving. Also, the Earth is moving, but you know, there's some relative movement between source and observer, but the plasma is roughly fixed. So this is if you know, we can simulate what's going on, and you get something that looks like this. So this is the secondary spectrum that I was talking about, and so we can recover these inverted arclets that you actually observe. And the idea here is that the scintillation is caused by these folds. Like structures in this corrugated sheet. So, you know, like I was saying, imagine that I now rotated this thing to be perfectly along the line of sight. You might get something that looks like this, where you have this sort of, you know, it folds over, the sheet kind of folds over. And then when you project it, you get some large density variation in projection. And then you say that each of these folds roughly has an image associated with it. And then, you know, you just get a bunch of images that form. And so this is from this paper by Dana Simard that she showed that, you know, you get basically recover these inverted arclet pictures by using this corrugated sheet model. And so this corrugated sheet model isn't actually, you know, all that new. It's something people have been thinking about for a while now. So what is actually new? Well, this is what I am arguing. And so basically, the corrugated sheet model is meant to explain scintillation with these folds. But I propose that that ESCs can also be explained with this model, except not by folds, but by cusps. So, you know, in the language of catastrophe theory, folds are A2 catastrophes and cusps are A3 catastrophes. And basically, a cusp is just when folds end. So, you know, you can imagine you have this corrugated sheet, right? And then it's extended along some dimension. But these corrugations aren't going to continue forever, right? They're going to end at some point. And you know, just sort of mathematically, they are constrained to end in these cusp-like features. So this is sort of the picture. Imagine this is the actual folded sheet. So you have these folds, but then at some point it comes to an end, and then it just smooths out into a flat sheet. That's what this is. And then when you project this gray folded sheet along the line of sight, well, perpendicular to the line of sight, you get this projected density, and then you get this nice cuspy structure. And then these just red lines just show what it looks like, you know, for some cross section. So here, you know, when kappa is just some parameter, when kappa is greater than zero, you know, you have this nice folded structure, which when projected looks like this. And then as kappa goes to less than zero, it sort of smooths out. So that's what the cusp looks like. So, you know, if folds, you know, these folded sheets really do explain scintillation, then these cusps are kind of a requirement. They must also exist. You know, this is just sort of how catastrophes work. If folds exist, then the cusps must exist somewhere. And so the question that one might ask is, could this explain other features, other things that we see in pulsars? And hopefully we could explain ESCs with this. So just to say what the model is, basically I'm just describing the lens potential by the magnification of the cusp. So like I was saying, imagine that the sort of canonical cusp magnification is now the lens potential itself. And this is described basically just by two unfolding parameters, this kappa and x that I labeled the axes here, these two unfolding parameters. And you know, it's just some basically described by some cubic lens equation. The details aren't super important. I should note that when I actually do the simulations, I'm not using formally. Get infinite magnification or infinite density, along the cusp here. I do smooth it out by something because this additional parameter is related to the thickness of the sheet. So you can compute the critical curves and caustics of this lens. That's why it's sort of the cusps of the cusp lens. Get something that looks like this is not super important, but basically, if you were to imagine, now you can actually compute the light curves that would be associated with an event like this. And so this is just an example of an event that we can simulate on the left here. I plot the original Fiedler et al. Observation on the right here because it's somewhat suggestive, I think. You have this at low frequencies, basically, I'll start with high frequencies. So the high frequency observation, if I go back to this, you have this caustic. Oh, I should say that the top panels are for the divergent lens and the bottom panel is for the convergent lens. I'm sort of agnostic about whether or not the plasma is over or under dense. You can do the calculation for either of these things. So you just imagine that the light curve now, say if I'm just taking just going across space along here for some kappa, then I'll encounter a bunch of caustics as I go along.
Yeah.
And then that's just what these caustics here are. I'm just going along and I encounter a bunch of caustics. And then as you go to lower frequencies, some of these caustics disappear, and you're basically just left with two caustics. And so that's interesting. The caustics don't, some of them disappear, but some of them don't. And they just sort of go out to infinity, basically, as you go to lower frequencies. And so that's sort of interesting, because maybe you can imagine that the right here is something like this is going on here. I not doing a precise quantitative comparison here. It's just sort of trying to get the qualitative aspects of this model at that's the sort of the stage this work is at, just trying to understand the qualitative aspects. There are lots, there are more complications that you know you can imagine adding in. For example, for this simulation, I've just fixed the I'll get into it. But you know, so this is just sort of a it's completely symmetric, right? You can imagine that you can add some asymmetry into how this this lens is unfolding. There are more details that you can add into it. But at the moment, we're just sort of looking at the qualitative features of this model and seeing if it could potentially explain what you actually see. And so from that standpoint, this is quite suggestive, I think, that you know, you get quite naturally, you know, at low frequencies, you get sort of a few caustics, and then these you gain more caustics as you go to higher frequencies, and they sort of squeeze in. That's quite sort of suggestive.
So can you say it again, like,
yeah.
Why the scattering is increasing towards low frequency, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So can you say again, like, why there's fewer caustics at the lower frequency?
Cleansing
is stronger.
Yeah. I use the. Yeah. Okay. But basically,
the lens. Let me see if I can get this right. The lens map looks something like this. Right. So this is these beta plots, right? You know, where this is your observer, your the observing angle, and then this is the theta, right? So here, if the image is forming, right? So this is sort of what this looks like. As you go to lower frequencies, basically what happens is the scattering gets stronger, as you're saying, right? So what happens is basically, you know, you get something that looks like this, but then these caustics go out even further, right? So this is sort of the lower frequency picture. But when, and as you go to even lower frequencies, these caustics sort of go out to infinity. And then also these caustics kind of go out to infinity. Not all of them, I guess. They all sort of spread out. And so at some point, you only ever see these inner caustics, right? Basically, that's the idea. So I guess I misspoke when saying the caustics disappear. They don't mathematically disappear. It's just they become very far away, so you never actually see them.
But there are like smaller like pools that then get amplified into. I mean, like in your picture, so you've drawn the 8 gigahertz pool. And then at 2 gigahertz, those ones go out to some larger angle.
Yeah.
And similarly, I would expect that there is smaller folds that we're not seeing at the 8 gigahertz, which then we do see at 2 gigahertz. So, am I misunderstanding? So, for example, like in your picture, there is, in your picture, there are those folds that are not reaching all the way to the, to line of sight.
Oh, yeah. So basically what's happening here is this inner thing here has been blown out, and that's actually these caustics here.
Right.
So you're seeing those inner folds. I mean, you're seeing them in both cases. It's not like they're magically appearing.
Uh-huh.
All of these, yeah. So it's sort of like these caustics here have gone out to infinity, but then this caustic has also been, not infinity, but they've gone out further away. And then this caustic, these caustics here are now these caustics. Yeah.
But is this structure that you're showing on the right like generic across these sources? You know, like in the sense that you see like smooth frequency. I mean smooth time dependence at at the low frequency and a much more jagged.
Yeah. This is sort of a generic feature where you get something that's, you get this sort of large thing and then a trough that's pretty generic. And then at high frequencies, you also see these, you know, more caustics that appear. Yeah, that's quite generic.
One more question.
Yeah.
So if this were the explanation, right? Then we would expect, a specific power law distribution of the projected surface densities.
Right. Yeah.
And so, is that what's seen?
So you mean like a power law in the intensity that you observe, like the scintillation that you observe?
No, so the inferred surface density of the plasma, right?
Right. I'm not sure about that. If that's so, what power law would you expect? I guess.
Well, so in the same way, that the magnifications for cusps, follow.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, I see what you mean. Yes. I'm not. I don't. I haven't looked into that. That's certainly one thing that. I talk about that a little bit later, that is sort of a prediction of this model, but I'm not sure, if that's, yes, you would expect that, but I don't think we have, at least, I probably the data is out there, maybe, I'm not sure if we could find this, easily answer this question, but that is a concrete prediction that, this could be tested against.
So how many of these ESEs are known?
So in terms of quasars, I'm not sure. I feel like it's tens of these. I'm not sure with quasars. With pulsars, like I was saying, you expect we see quite a few. The data is not great on all of them, as I will show, because you basically often don't observe them throughout the entire period. You just sort of see some bright thing that happens once, but sort of this sort of happens like 1% of the time. So that's something that you actually need to, that we want to actually go and look at, to actually follow these ESEs as they are happening in pulsars. But I'm not sure about quasars. How much data we have on quasars. So this is getting to your point. If this model is correct, then this would, provide a unified framework for both scintillation and ESEs. Scintillation is described by folds, ESEs by cusps. This would be quite a useful thing, because if these lenses are indeed catastrophes, then their form is, just from catastrophe theory, their form is generic, and they're described by a small number of parameters, basically. And this would be quite a big step forward from where you have infinite degrees of freedom and you can do whatever you want. Well, now you have sort of a small number of parameters that actually describe your lensing. And then, we have these, as Neil was saying, these well-known scaling relations, for these fold and cusp cross-sections. So basically the idea is that the fold, if you say that you have set some threshold for what, the density has to be above this amount, delta, say, then the fold scales, cross-section scales like delta to minus 2, and then the cusp scales delta to minus 5/2. And so for one thing, it immediately explains something that it might be confusing. If you assume that both of these ESEs and scintillation are caused by the same structure, why do they occur at different rates, right? Scintillation seems to be ubiquitous, but these ESEs, not rare, but not that common. The scaling result sort of explains that a little bit anyway. Imagine this being the case, that even though you might expect these cusps, they're large magnifications, you might expect them to dominate, but actually in terms of cross-section, the folds dominate. And so you actually would expect the scintillation events to happen, to be more frequent. But then, the scaling relation is precise, and so it is something that you actually want at and see if the data actually matches those relations. And I think if it did, I think that would be quite strong evidence for a picture like this. But I picture that we have in mind. Well, the physical picture comes from this, basically, it's an older idea where the ISM is just this turbulent medium that's stirred on some 10 to the 2 parsec scale, like supernovae, things like that. And you know, it turns out that in simulations of the ISM, these folded magnetic field structures can occur on scales smaller than the stirring scale. So folded magnetic field structures are basically these things where you have the magnetic field goes in one direction, and then just across from it, it flips direction. So you can see that in different places on this thing. Here it's going in one direction, and then it's going in the other direction here. And then naturally, what happens is that you get these plasma current sheets that form on the boundaries between these, where the magnetic field changes direction. And then a thing that happens is you get these Alvain waves, which can propagate along the current sheets, and that's sort of our picture for what's causing these corrugations. And I should say that this is sort of a plausible physical model. It's plausible because you can get these current sheets and they persist. From simulations, you can get them to persist for roughly the right time scale that you need to explain these ESEs. But I'm no expert on the ISM and plasma, turbulent plasma simulations. So this is just sort of a plausible scenario that maybe could explain it. But this sort of framework of doubly catastrophic lensing is not dependent on the physics, really. Because really all it needs is that you have thin sheets that are projected. That's really the only thing that's required. So I would say that these things, need to be there, like these folds and these cusps are going to generically be there if you have thin sheets. The real question is whether or not they occur at the right scale and the right frequency to explain all of these observations. But they should be there. And that seems to be independent of what you actually think is the physical process you actually think is going on. So there's this, yeah.
Has anybody tried to just look through one of these simulations? Basically put the pulsar behind them and see what sort of light curves you get.
Oh, one of these sort of plasma simulations?
Yeah,
there are things that you can do with, there have been things like that. But the problem with that is it can be quite challenging to actually do the simulation because you have to do like these full wave optics calculations, which can be quite challenging. But I don't think there has been any. There have definitely been a few papers that have attempted things like that, but it's just sort of a challenging calculation to do because if you're trying to propagate your waves through this whole turbulent medium along your line of sight, that's sort of harder to do. These lensing calculations are easy when you think it's confined to a plane. But when you're now allowing it for it to be extended along the whole line of sight, that becomes much more challenging to do. And because the scale of these things is quite small, the expected scale is quite small, you'd have to simulate a lot of these eddies to actually get a good feel for what's going on. That's a challenging thing to do. So then we also, time, so I'm not talking too long. So there's this another event that we have that we've been analyzing. So this is in the pulsar 0834, and this is sort of an extreme scattering event. So what is going on here? So this is just showing the top is just the secondary spectrum, and the bottom row is this conjugate wave field that I was talking about. And so you get this normal scintillation arc that's sort of common. And then we also see this feature up here, which I'll call the millisecond feature, because it has millisecond delays. And then we watch it, we can watch it, well, I say we, this was published
a month ago, I think. And I'm not on that paper, so I shouldn't say me. But you know, this is data that was taken. And so, you know, one can watch this feature evolve in time. Unfortunately, they didn't get it every day or whatever. It just happened. They just saw this. Just observed for 4 days, but you can only see it for these 4 days. So what makes it an extreme scattering event? Just looking at this doesn't look that extreme. But basically, because it has this large millisecond time delay associated with it, you can infer that it has these large bending angles. So roughly 83 microarcseconds is the bending angle that you can infer from this. And likewise, if you assume spherical symmetry, then you get an inferred plasma density of 10 to the 3 cubic centimeters, roughly. So basically, it would be nice if we had seen it for the entire period, and then you could see its magnification go up and down and say, oh, this is an ESE. But unfortunately, it was just for the 4 days. So it seems like an ESE because it has these large bending angles, and it has this large density with it. So if this, if the inferred plasma structure, should cause an ESE if it were lensed by something else, or if it lensed something else. And then the time scale occurred for at least 48 days. So
you said large density, but so where do you get this pressure from? So when you say, and then the previous statement you were making about large pressure. So how do you infer pressure from the density?
Right, so you basically just, it's basically just ideal gas, essentially.
You assume it's temperature.
It's ionized gas, right? So it should be temperature.
Why would it be 10 to the 4 Kelvin? It could be colder.
I forget the precise relation, but it just comes out from, the ionized gas.
It's 10 to the 4 Kelvin, but it could be places where it's colder, and that could be these sheets.
I suppose that's... So you're saying that you have this 10 to the 4... So yeah, I guess what you're saying is if this temperature was lower, then you would infer a pressure that is smaller if you're in a colder region.
Yeah, I suppose that's possible.
Can it stay ionized if it's far below 10 to the 4?
Yeah, I think.
Depends on the the density,
right? It's like a very high 3D density is the inference, right?
Well, that's the electron density. Yes, but yeah, right, that's the high density. That's, I guess the question is, why is it a combination, right? That is a good point. I don't know.
I don't really know the good answer. I don't have a good answer to your question, but I do know that lots of people who know more about plasma physics, tell me that the pressure would have to be high. And I think it's because of this, where you assume the density of it needs to be that temperature in order to sustain an ionized plasma at that density. In any case, we sort of expect that this event is something like an extreme scattering event. I can look at it as a function of frequency. So this is the same event, but I've zoomed in here on the left on this millisecond feature in the Doppler delay space. And then this right panel just shows the magnification as a function of frequency. So if I just play this, you can see it getting bright and dim again. Bright again. So you get these large intensity variations.
What are the axes
here? So the axes are the same axes as the previous slide. So just the Doppler and the time delay in units of microseconds.
You're looking at the top left?
Yeah, okay. I just zoomed in sort of on this red thing, on that thing. So it just gets, oops. So then this is just showing the total intensity as a function of frequency. So you get these large. So what do we think is going on here? So in that Zhu et al. Paper that I mentioned, so this paper, you know, they did VLBI on this source, and you know, they were able to you know, infer a lot about what was going on, and they found that it is best explained by two screens. So you have this main scattering screen, which is causing this scintillation arc, your typical scintillation arc, and then you have a second scattering screen that is causing this millisecond feature. Basically, you get this. Yeah, basically, the second scattering screen is just forming. You know, it's causing roughly two images to form. One is just this normal scattering screen, and then you have this second image up here, which would be a copy of this bottom scattering screen. So our proposal is that the second lens is actually this A3 lens, and I will show that we can sort of match the data by using this model. So this is, you know, trying to simulate the same event but using an A3 this A3 lens, and so you can sort of roughly get the idea, and you can match the qualitative features. So I should point out what the qualitative features we're actually trying to match are. So the first thing that we're trying to match is that this millisecond feature is truncated, basically. So if I use, I'll just draw that again. If I imagine that my second lens, so we have these two lens planes, you know, and if I imagine that the second lens plane just sort of formed two images, and it was sort of infinitely extended along this direction, then what I would expect to get in the Doppler delay space is I would expect to get my primary scintillation arc, right? And then if it forms sort of a second image, I would expect to get something that looks like this, right? I would expect to just get a copy. That's sort of what happens in lensing. You just get another image that's a copy of the first image. So I would expect to get something like this. But that's not what we see. So what we see is something that's very asymmetric. So that means that, for one thing, this lens can't continue forever, right? It has to be truncated. And that sort of is very easy to accommodate with the A3 lens, because, I mean, it's a cusp. It naturally cuts itself off. It's a lens, and then it stops being one. Sort of the first feature that we're able to naturally explain this. So it is sort of a small lens, not a small lens, but you don't get a full copy of this parabolic arc. You just get this sort of island feature. And then if we zoom in on it, another thing that we can explain is, it's a little bit hard to see, but it's just because the resolution in the data is not great. But what we kind of see is that as you approach, the images sort of come together in delay, and then they spread out again. So you can see that these images, these islands of power, are sort of coming, pinching off, and then spreading out again. And that's something that also naturally comes up in the A3 lens. And basically, it's because the cusp is sort of loopy. It's very scientific, but you know, you have it comes in at the cusp, and then you have this sort of loopy structure, and that just causes the time delays to increase. So you know, you expect the time delays to get close to each other, and then they sort of fan out again, and then they once again come close to each other. So that's another qualitative that we can match. And then finally, we can actually look at this magnification that I showed. And so one thing that, again, will happen very generically in this is that you get a bunch of images that are formed by this A3 cusp. And then as you go to higher frequencies, as I was saying with the thing I just erased, you know, you sort of, the cusps, it sort of shrinks, but anyway, basically the images merge, and generically what happens when images merge is they get infinitely bright, formally infinitely bright. And you get something that looks like this. You know, if you have a bunch of images, they're going to merge at different times. And so you basically just get a bunch of these bright peaks that are delayed in time. And that's maybe what we see here. It's sort of hard to see that, hard to say that that's what we're seeing here in this picture. That is actually a little bit more clear when I play the video. At this speed, it's a little bit challenging to see, but you can actually track as you're going through. You can actually track that these certain images are merging here, getting infinitely bright and then disappearing. So, like, for example, if I try to pause, but if I start out. So, for example, if I start out, it's a little hard to see. But if I start out here, and then, you know, it gets infinitely bright, and then I am left with actually fewer images on this side than I had before. So basically what's happening is, you know, a few of these delta functions are merging, getting infinitely bright, and then disappearing. And that's something that you know, quite generically happens with our model. So again, you know, none of this is quantitative. There are lots of complications to the model that we could imagine adding in to hopefully actually get a quantitative match. But I think sort of I would say that we are able to match at least some of these qualitative features in very easily and naturally in ways that other models have not been able to do. So I think that's sort of exciting. And also, I should say that, you know, another thing that's very exciting about this is that, you know, it provides a universal framework for both scintillation and DSEs, which is a thing that also other models haven't been able to do. So, you know, this model achieves things that, you know, when I started out with those goals of a good theoretical model, I think this model achieves all of those things. But there's certainly a lot more work to be done to actually try to quantitatively match these things and actually look at the, you know, some of the precise predictions of this model. But certainly as a first step, I think some of these qualitative predictions, you know, look pretty good. So I think I probably should stop talking now. But I did want to talk about some of the applications of this, but it is not, you know, that is sort of very speculative anyway. Just the idea is that the main gist of it is that, you know, you can imagine that since these catastrophes are very simple, you can imagine actually using these things for something. You know, in the same way that we use gravitational lensing for like cosmology, the reason that we can do that is because, you know, with micro lenses or with galaxies, the lens is quite simple. You know, there are complications, but, you know, you can model the mass of a galaxy with sort of simple NSF. You know, the profile, yeah, W profile, and that's quite simple. And, you know, that's sort of the reason we can use these lenses, gravitational lenses, to actually do science. So you could imagine that if indeed the plasma lenses were also simple in structure, you could start doing things with it. And then also, you know, as I mentioned at the beginning, it sort of has implications for pulsar timing arrays and stuff. You know, because if you can actually, you know, if you know what's actually doing the lensing, you can maybe overcome this systematic glitch that you have to worry about, where you get with this, these scattering structures induce excess time delays and sort of mess up things. But yeah, that's sort of the gist of the applications. But yeah, so I guess I will end here just to summarize. You know, this doubly catastrophic lensing. It provides a unified framework for both scintillation and extreme scattering. It's a simple framework, so it's, you know, it's governed by very few parameters. You know, we've been able to qualitatively explain several features in scattering observations that have so far been challenging to accommodate in more standard models. I would also just stress that these catastrophes, you know, they should naturally arise in any thin plane description of lensing. So the expectation is that these are there. It's really just a question of whether or not they can explain what we actually see. time, so I guess I will stop there.
Questions for Dylan? For the plot on the blackboard, the first image is symmetric about the zero frequency, right? But why the second is not?
Oh, well, so it's not actually, if I go to here, it's not actually symmetric about the first,
It looks pretty symmetric to me.
Well, I mean, it has this sort of tail that kind of goes up here, right? It sort of ends here. But yeah, it is pretty symmetric in comparison. that's just because, I mean, when you sort of, the idea is that we have these corrugated sheets, and these corrugations do, you know, are quite extended in space, and so that's why you can get these sort of very symmetric things. But then these cusps are sort of naturally asymmetric, and that's why you actually get this truncated, if it were to be lens by cusp. Does that make sense?
So in this picture that you're showing, right, you know, so then this, you know, this other image with this millisecond delay, you're saying that it has like some, well, it has some relative deflection of like a milliard second, is that
right? Yeah, that's right.
So is it possible to use like VLBI to actually like, to actually like distinguish those two images from each other?
Yes, that would be the goal. Yeah, that's sort of one thing we want to do. We don't have that data, you know, we haven't done that, but yeah, it would be possible to do that. And I think that's one other thing I should say, that this is a very testable, this model, and it will be tested soon. Because, you know, I mean, China is building these outriggers to do exactly this.
If there are no more questions, let's thank the speaker again.